Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
I'm Candace LaPage.
And Candace, you escaped Saturday's storm okay?
I did.
Nothing tried to eat you?
No, but maybe a little bit later I'll ironically tell you what I was watching during the storm.
Ooh, I enjoy irony viewing. Mm-hmm. We'll stay on the edge of our seats for that one. End Credits is a local movie show for our local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be a shift away from the movie that opened at $184 million this past weekend, so not The Lion King. We're talking about The Killer Gator Horror Crawl. That will be in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including TIFF. For the first time in almost 10 years, the opening night film is going to be Canadian. But why is this such a bold move for Canada's biggest film festival? And then Cats, the classic Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, is coming to theaters this fall. And the first look at the film has got a lot of people talking for maybe the wrong reasons. So we'll talk about it too. And then finally, since we're reviewing a creature feature this week, we'll talk about some of our favorite creature features. But first, not speaking of creatures, because she can play whatever creature she wants. Yeah, we're talking, of course, about Scarlett Johansson. The actress was interviewed in a recent magazine profile, aptly titled As If. And she stepped in when she told the interviewer that as an actor, she had a right to play any person, plant, or animal she wanted. This is, of course, a reference to a controversy last year where social media, quite rightly, I think, was angry at her. In the aftermath of playing a Japanese woman in Ghost in the Shell, she decided she was going to play a trans man in a independent drama called Rub and Tug, which is about the life of Dante Tex Gill, who was a trans man in the 1970s, and this was her response when she was asked about it. Interestingly, it came on the same weekend. Let me grab my notes.
They're so far away.
I know, it just, the space in here is weird. Anyway, it came on the same weekend, Lashana Lynch, it was announced that she was playing 007 in the new James Bond movie. Yes, and a lot of people read that immediately to mean that she was playing James Bond after Daniel Craig in the subsequent James Bond movies. But what actually it was announcing was that at the beginning of the next film, because James Bond retired at the end of Spectre, there's a new agent 007, and it's a new character played by Lashana Lynch. Mm-hmm. So we meet her at the beginning of this next Bond film. She is 007, not Jane Bond. And
but what would be wrong if she was anyways? But that's a totally different
right.
Argument.
Nothing would be like when I first saw that on Twitter, I was like, oh my god, like she's gonna play like the first black female James Bond. That's mm-hmm. awesome. And then I read the story and I was like, oh, people are just gonna blow out of proportion. And they did. And there was right wing weasel Ben Shapiro had a whole monologue about it, about how it was gonna ruin, you know, the fantasy for mm-hmm. white men everywhere to see a black woman be a spy. And I'm thinking, thank you, irony. As Scarlett Johansson's talking about, why can't I play anything I want?
Yeah.
And that's the reaction we get when a black woman is almost cast as James Bond.
Yeah. And I do want to come back to ScarJo in a second. But also, I mean, it's just a week later from mm-hmm. that news. And of course, now we have Lady Thor. Oh my goodness.
Yes, that was announced at Comic-Con over the weekend. If people didn't miss it, the new Marvel slate, that Natalie Portman is coming back to Thor. And that mm-hmm. she, following in the comic books, actually.
This is actually canon, people. Get off your high horses.
Jane Foster becomes a female iteration of Thor.
Yeah. So... obviously, this is, as we're discussing, this is why what Scarlett Johansson had to say is wrong, mm-hmm. period, end of sentence, it's wrong. I will give her just a little bit of leeway, though, because when she's talking about art mm-hmm. and making art, mm-hmm. she is right. As an actor making art, an actor's job is to play something that is not them.
Yep.
Period.
Yep.
So if that is a plant or a tree or a trans man, that is actually the art of acting. The reality, though, is that she, I don't want to say she's not an artist, but we're not talking about art. We're talking about entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about the entertainment industry, which mm-hmm. means jobs. Mm-hmm. Period. Like that's the end of it. It's like I don't disagree with you if we're talking about the art form. And if you were doing little fringe theater in a tiny, you know, play, you know, that you were self-funding.
Right.
Yes, sure, absolutely. And it could be really interesting, right? For a bunch of white women to, you know, play 12 Angry Black Men or something.
Right.
Right? That could be interesting. But that is not the art that you are making. What you are doing is actually part of an industry. And for all these white people who complain that immigrants are taking their jobs.
Right.
She's literally taking the job away from someone who could do it.
There's a fascinating thing where she's absolutely right. Like, an actor should be able to play whatever they want. And then there's the other recent casting controversy with Hailey Bailey cast as the Little Mermaid.
Yes.
And you think to yourself, that's a case of Scarlett Johansson being right. Anybody can play any
absolutely.
Part. But look at the crap storm that created, where people were like making these bizarre scientific, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but this bizarre scientific argument that, well, she lives in the deep ocean, so she doesn't get sunlight, so she doesn't produce melatonin, so how can she have dark skin? How she's a freaking mermaid.
You can make no scientific... No. She is a fantasy creature, period.
She's a freaking mermaid. She can be whatever race that the producers and the directors decide. But, I mean, that is proving Scarlett Johansson's point.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it is exceptionally difficult for trans actors to get parts that are not trans.
It's true.
And, you know, if Scarlett Johansson wants to play a trans man, I think that day will come, to go back to James Bond, when a trans woman plays a Bond girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because she's a trans, it's just because she's a woman, she's good for the part, and there you go. And I think that's kind of the key distinction in all this, is that in the theoretical, Scarlett Johansson's right, in the minutia of how things really, really work. It's really hard for people of a minority or an ethnic group to get parts that aren't part of that minority or ethnic group. Even though, I mean, it is a shift when someone like Lashana Lynch is cast as a spy character in a Bond movie. But we're not there yet, the point.
Yeah.
And she should know better, because Ghost in the Shell. And you can make it takes place in the future, blah, 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 blah. But that is, and maybe this is what's holding up the Akira remake, because the reason there's a Thor 4 now is because a Taika Waititi can't get to making Akira. And it's maybe because he's insisting, like, it's a Japanese movie, so maybe there should be Japanese people in it. But this has been the struggle in Hollywood that, you know, we're going to class the black sidekick. But, you know, sometimes the black guy isn't the hero, or the black woman, or the Hispanic woman or man. It's still a very white-centric star system that Scarlett Johansson takes tremendous advantage of.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, it's sort of similar to, was it Glenn Close who was talking about how, you know, we're all the same race.
Mm-hmm.
We all started in Africa. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of one of those things where it's like, what you said isn't necessarily wrong.
Right.
And might not be bad if it was coming from someone else, but you are already benefiting from systemic racism.
Well, and she also...
And what you've said hasn't stopped systemic racism.
Yeah. She also benefited from playing a trans character in Albert Nobbs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of fun. Like, that was barely... I think that was barely, not even 10 years ago. So it's funny how the world has shifted in that regard. I mean, but also, Glenn Close is not Scarlett Johansson. Glenn Close is an incredibly well-regarded and successful actress, but she is not, like, marquee material the way Scarlett Johansson is. And Albert Nobbs was certainly a smaller movie. I mean, I don't think Rub and Tug was going to be, like $100 million, but because Scarlett Johansson's involved. And it was also clearly one of those things, like, I'm going to win an Oscar now.
Yes.
By playing a trans man. So, I mean, all these things are sort of pin needles in this situation. And you kind of take one out and it all stings. And I think she should have I think she should have known better than to rip the Band-Aid off again.
Yeah.
And then she really should have known better than to go and say, well, they just kind of chop-sockied what I was saying to make clickbait. And it's like, Scarlett, this was going to be clickbait anyway, no matter what context.
Yeah. Period.
And it was As If magazine, so, you know, as if.
And I mean, it's not like these superstar actors aren't given media training.
Yes. Yes.
So.
Yeah. I mean, like, now more than ever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't know if, like, maybe she was feeling the stress of, like, the Black Widow shoot or whatever's going on. But, yeah, it was inelegant how she approached it. And hopefully this is the last we've heard of it. And I look forward to seeing Laverne Cox in Bond 26 playing the Bond girl.
Ooh.
But, of course, they had Monica Bellucci in Spectre and utterly wasted her, so.
I don't know. I didn't see Spectre. I just watched Skyfall.
I think again. You're fine.
Yeah. Let's see. I could go see Spectre or I could watch Skyfall for the sixth time.
Skyfall is solid.
Skyfall it is.
Also solid is usually TIFF. They usually have a lot of interesting movies, but what is TIFF now in its 42nd, 43rd year?
I think 43. Yeah, I just, you know, did some reading about that today. You think I would have noticed that?
Yeah, I think I would have noticed it too. Because I did a deep dive into all the movies that have opened TIFF in the 21st century.
Excellent, because I had a different question about this particular headline. So.
Okay. Well, what was your question?
Well, how many documentaries have opened TIFF?
Ah, very good.
Because I feel like that, to me, the fact that a Canadian film is opening TIFF is fine, great, whatever. But how many, I mean, TIFF has become the, San Diego Comic-Con of movies, right?
You're not wrong. I think From the Sky Down, the Davis Guggenheim movie, mm-hmm. was a documentary in 2011.
Yeah, like it seems rare for it to be a documentary. It's usually like a massive tentpole narrative film
mm-hmm.
that is bound for Oscars, is already, like everything, so feels like so many of their movies now are already distributed. Yeah. This is just a way for them to get them in front of people.
Right.
Before December 31st.
Right. No, and I mean, it's also competing with Venice, which is Venice and Telluride, which the three of them kind of overlap.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this big controversy a couple of years ago, like, well, films that open Telluride can't open Toronto, and films that open Venice can't open Telluride, and because they're all trying to use these three festivals to launch award hopefuls. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this year's opening film is Once We're Brothers, Robbie Robertson and the Band. It will be the world premiere for this documentary. I can't remember the director's name, unfortunately, but it is being executive produced by Martin Scorsese, Ron Howard, and Brian Grazer. So even though it's...
Yeah, that was my next question about it.
Yeah, so even though it's a film about a Canadian musician, a Canadian band, I think the Canadian himself is a director opening mm-hmm. a Canadian festival. It seems to sneak in there because it's got these marquee names behind it, and you're going to have Scorsese and Ron Howard on the red mm-hmm. carpet and
yeah.
talking
now,
about
Now, I
it.
Don't want to take Robbie Robertson's Canadianism away from him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One is, he is loudly and proudly Indigenous from Six Nations.
Mm-hmm. Down the road.
So, you know, as we go around going, oh, our Canadian Robbie Robertson, it's like, well, let's be a little more careful with our ownership of
right.
And then the other being, because when you sent me the link, I was like, oh, interesting. I wonder what Canadian film it is. I'm like, it's a film about the Band? This is the least Canadian band of all time. I mean,
right.
I still consider them a Canadian band. But come on, Martin Scorsese made a documentary about this band.
Yeah,
they
Last
toured
Waltz.
With Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
This is as like Canadian of a band as, I don't know, Nickelback? Maybe that's a poor example. Neil Young. I mean, this is...
Please,
this
the is, band made music.
Yeah. This is... and not that I don't want to get on a high horse about Canadian art and blah, blah, blah.
No.
But this is a band that went to the States and made it big.
Yeah.
And very, very big.
Mm-hmm.
Like...
Well, big enough that Martin Scorsese made a documentary about their last performance.
Like, there are lots of people all across North America who know that Rush is a Canadian band. The people in Florida who love Rush who are like, oh yeah, this Canadian band. People all across North America, including Canada, go, really? The band is Canadian? Mm. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. Because they freaking toured with Bob Dylan. They are, to use the words of another Canadian band. Actually, maybe they're not Canadian. Who did We're an American Band?
What's that?
Grand Funk Railroad?
That was Grand Funk Railroad. I don't think they were.
They're not Canadian. They're an American band. Yeah.
So the song was aptly titled.
Yes. I was thinking it was the Guess Who for a second, but that's American Woman.
Yes, that is true. Remade
Back
by Lenny
Tiff.
Kravitz, an American Man. But yeah, I do find it is... It is like sort of nakedly kind of trying to play to the Canadian while still saying like Americans will dig this too. But it's not like the Magnificent Seven, which opened in 2016. It's not like The Fifth Estate, which was the movie about Assange and WikiLeaks that Bill Condon did. Or The Judge, which was Robert Downey Jr. trying to, you know, get some of the Avengers magic, you know, to try and, get him more drama consideration. It is, though, I mean, because it has been almost 10 years. The last time a Canadian movie, you could almost include Demolition, which was directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who is a Canadian, but it was an American film with American financiers. But last time a Canadian movie opened TIFF was 2010. Do you know what one it was?
Was it? Nope, that was definitely too late. I was going to say Crazy, but that's too late.
It was Score, the hockey musical.
I mean, can you get more Canadian than the band? Yes, Score, the hockey musical.
Yeah. But I mean, before that, like every movie from 1999 to 2009 when Creation opened TIFF, every one of those was a Canadian movie. And it wasn't. It was stuff like Deepa Mehta's Water. You know, Fugitive Pieces, Passchendaele. Stardom. I think that was Donna Keller. Felicia's Journey, which was a Nagoyan film. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a chance to let these luminaries of Canadian cinema, show their stuff, in front of the world stage. I mean, granted, TIFF has changed a lot since even 99. But, even though we're like, it just feels like we're tipping the toe in Canadiana.
Yeah.
But if Scorsese wasn't behind this and Ron Howard wasn't behind this, this would be, playing at, Scotiabank at, 2:15 on a Monday. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we will eagerly await the full list of TIFF films, which will come out in a couple of weeks, and we'll see about that. In the meantime, we got other stuff to talk about, very important and disturbing things, and we'll just cue it up this way. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU. If you are a music theater nerd, you probably need no introduction to that little piece of music. It is from the original Broadway recording of Cats, the Andrew Lloyd the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical about cats just, trying to live life and get rich and die. I can't remember.
Isn't that Rent?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I am mildly a musical theater nerd, and I have never seen the play Cats. I've never listened to any of the music from it. It just completely is not part of my.
I remember it from school. I remember we did it like a music class. Listen to the soundtrack. But I mean, that was because it was like the mid 80s when Cats opened in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And Retro Ontario posted like the original TV ad for Cats where it's like they're flying away on a UFO in it.
Yeah, I have like no idea. I have absolutely no idea what this story is about.
Yeah.
And apparently neither did, I don't know, 3/4 of the population of Twitter, apparently. I was right there with them.
Right. Because there's a live action movie adaptation of Cats that's coming out this December. It's from Tom Hooper, who did The King's Speech and Les Miserables. And it stars Idris Elba, Taylor Swift, Jodie Dench, Jennifer Hudson, Ian McKellen, Jason Derulo, Rebel Wilson, and a new young woman, Francesca Hayward, who is a veteran. She's the principal ballerina, I should say, of the Royal Ballet. This is her first big movie role. And, you know, when you watch the trailer, they've gone to it. I think what they've done is, and I took this from the behind the scenes feature they released, is that the cat attire is mm-hmm. all CG.
Yes.
It's a CG makeup job. Yep. But they built the practical sets at like sort of cat uh-huh. perspective. So like the furniture is huge and the streets look huge.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like the uncanny valley-ness of the cat CG makeup mm-hmm. and the physical sets that are like huge, like compared to the human perspective, I think that's what's effed up a lot of people.
Yeah. And I will also, so, I mean, I was already like, whoa, this is weird. But there were two other things that made me uncomfortable.
Okay.
One is how unremarkable Taylor Swift's face is. Honest to God, I had to keep looking going, am I supposed to believe that's Taylor Swift?
She has beautiful gowns.
Like, it's just, it's really weird. I was like, whoa, if you just have like a bit of her face, she is nobody. She is mm-hmm. so like factory prepared pretty that she has no identifiable features. Like I still, like I've watched it, I think 3 times. I'm like, I don't see Taylor Swift there at all.
Yeah. I wouldn't have known which one is Taylor Swift if I hadn't watched the featurette.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that is, I'm not sure that there is a good way to say this.
Oh,
but
boy.
I was really weirded out by the actresses, so the women actors mm-hmm. portraying cats and their breasts. It was weird to me. I'm like, I understand women in a bodysuit.
Yeah.
I don't understand a cat with human breasts.
Yeah.
It's just, I was like, what is happening? What is happening?
Yeah, it's like, it's too close to, like, it's not like the stage show. It's more like Island of Dr. Moreau.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's kind of, like, it freaky about it. Because when you see those clips from the stage show, it's like it's people with cat ears and cat makeup. And, you know, it's more anthropomorphized than in this where it's like, no, they're cats, but they're walking on their hind legs and ballet dancing and stuff. And, yeah, it's like the two halves of your brain are clashing as you're mm-hmm. watching this. And it's like, those aren't people, but they've made it so that they're not people. They're cats, but they're
yeah.
not cats.
Like, it's weird, because I get it. Like animated things
yeah.
put breasts on their women characters to,
yeah.
and eyelashes so that you know that they're women.
Right.
And, like, you know, I've gotten over that. It's been 43 years of that. Like, I get it. It's weird that this rabbit has breasts, but I understand it's because yeah. that's a woman rabbit.
Right.
But it's really weird in this.
Right. Because you can't, like, if you saw two, unless you really know rabbits, you wouldn't know in real life which was the male rabbit and which was the female rabbit.
Yeah, no, you have zero idea.
And similar to cats, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the thing I was trying to focus on, I think, was like what a weird concoction Tom Hooper's put together here. Because the featurette focused a lot on like the performance. So like there mm-hmm. was a lot with Taylor Swift, there was a lot with Jason Derulo, there was a lot with Jennifer Hudson. So I've been focused on that. I've been focused on, like, this is like a 1980s. Like, the Cats is so 80s.
Yeah.
It's almost painfully 80s. Even though there's really nothing there that kind of, like, solidifies it to it, like, it, there seems like an element of timelessness to it. But I mean, it opened on Broadway, I think, in 81, so it's sort of quintessentially 80s. They have the choreography being done by Andy Blockenbuehler, who did the choreography for Hamilton. Mm-hmm. So it's like he worked on this incredibly modern musical, now bring in to do this very 80s, this kind of throwback musical. And on top of it all, you have this like mishmash of like dancing styles, where you have Francesca Hayward, the ballerina, you have like people who do hip hop choreography. It's just everything about this feels, I don't know, like kitchen sinky. Like they're just yeah, throwing everything they have at it. Whereas I think like Cats alone should bring a certain demographic to the theater. Like, I feel like a lot of these musicals from that era do, maybe.
I don't know. Were people who really liked Cats on Broadway?
Well, it's I think it's still the longest running Broadway musical.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people were going to it, like, I think up till the turn of the century, I think past the turn of the century.
It's just, I don't know. And did it come out of nowhere? It seemed like absolutely nobody was prepared for this.
Well, Taylor Swift herself said that she went from her tour to rehearsal.
Yeah. Like, how was this so under the radar for everybody?
I mean, that's interesting, too. And, you know, what else? I don't know. I don't think it had a presence at Comic-Con, but it also comes out on Comic-Con weekend, which is a bit weird, like when there's like a glut of trailers and new material. Yeah. So I don't know if they were trying to do under the...
It's bizarre. Has taken me a really long time
to
believe that this wasn't just a fake trailer. Like, they all got together to make the trailer.
Like, it's the latest... who's that guy? Waiting for Guffman.
Christopher
Guest. That's Guest, right. Like, it's one of his.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, all they're doing is making the trailer. There's no movie. They just got, like, the star-studded cast together just to make a trailer. Because they're like, wouldn't it be hilarious? Could you imagine if we actually did a movie?
Like, with Idris Elba, who I'm sure, he's a performer, so I'm sure he's, like, musically inclined, but I would have never guessed in a million years you would put Idris Elba in Cats. Nobody said, like, what's your dream cast for Cats? Idris Elba!
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. Somebody remixed the trailer to use the I've Got Five on It version from Us over the Cats.
Oh my God, is it terrifying?
It's
I should watch it.
Terrifying. It's almost too perfect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which should tell you everything about Cats. But we're going to talk about legit horror.
Real creatures.
Because this week's review is Crawl, so we're going to just quickly recap some of our favorite creature features. And this was your idea, so why don't you go first?
Yeah, well, so I realized after I suggested this, I'm like, oh, this is really tough because there's two totally different types of creature features. Mm-hmm. There's the, like, B-movie, like, Roger Corman, drive-in classic B, like, creature features, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, like, the legitimate horror film creature features, like Jaws, you could say, right? So there are actually, you know, so I was sort of like, oh, I wonder which creature features I meant. And then I decided, I'll just throw them all in.
Why not?
I will say that my absolute favorite creature feature is one of the, like, Saturday Drive-In B movies, and it's one of the newer ones made by Asylum Films, and it's Megapython versus Gatoroid, which is my absolute favorite because it stars Debbie Gibson and Tiffany, both of which have separately been in some of those, like, Asylum. Like, Tiffany was in Mega Piranha, and Debbie Gibson, I think, was in one of the Mega Shark or Shark, What are those series called again?
The Sharknado?
No, not the Sharknado. Previous to Sharknado.
These are the people who make Sharknado, that series.
Yeah, they made much better films before Sharknado, believe me.
Right.
Much better creature features.
Hard to make worse.
So this film is great because, one, it stars these two, like, 80s pop starlets, and it's almost like they're each on the side, one of the Gatoroids and the other of the Megapythons.
Right.
And they're both, like, scientists, they're super smart women, and it's great because it totally like pits them against each other, and there's a big fight, and then in the end they have to come together and work together to because they've both unleashed these terrifying things on the world, and so I love it. It's women led, it's women working together after having a very typical sort of women workplace relationship where they're both trying to be the best. You can read so much into it.
That's deep. I might have to check it out now.
That's how B creature features are.
Yeah, no. I went with Anaconda,
J-Lo.
Yeah, it's like sort of pre-star J-Lo. Ice Cube's in it too. Like you can refer to, I think the creature most people think refers to the snake. I think the creature, real creature in it is like John Voight, who's playing like Puerto Rican by way of Helsinki, I think.
Speaking of people who can play whoever they want.
That's right. So, you know, he's like a snake hunter, and this documentary film crew is in the Amazon trying to find this mythical giant snake. John Voight co-ops the crew into helping him hunt it, and, you know, fortunately he gets the quint in the end.
to coin a term?
He gets the quint. Yeah, I mean, it's like funny. I mean, the snake, because it's mostly CG, although I think there was like a practical rubber snake. It certainly looks like it. But the CG snake, like, it was like done on the fast and the cheap. So you can definitely see the pixels in it like 23 years later now. Mm-hmm. But you can't say it's not a fun movie. And I think that's like one of the, to go back to what you were saying, there's a genuine scary creature feature, and then there's the ones that are just fun. And you know that it's, you're just kind of in there for a good time and see how like all the characters become fodder or food or whatever it is. So, but Anaconda is a lot of fun. And I think it's still worth visiting for John Voight, whatever accent he's doing.
Yes. Gone. So I have also, because it's the summer and it's been super duper hot, I've been actually going back and every once in a while I sit in front of my TV. I'm like, I just really want to watch some sort of like water-based creature feature. So I've been watching a lot of these. And so I recently rewatched Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is
creature not, in the title.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the first creature feature, but it's probably the one that most people look to as like this sort of set the whole thing up and you know. And I don't know if I've ever actually seen the movie entirely. I know bits and pieces of it here. Mm-hmm. But so I sat down and watched the whole thing, and it is really good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was filmed in like 58 or something, and there's so much underwater work done, which is really incredible for the time. And, you know, they do such a great job of giving you, like, pathos for the actual creature. Mm-hmm. Like, you sort of feel for him while also being terrified of him. I mean, I guess King Kong would be it's basically King Kong, but underwater.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe King Kong is the original creature feature. But either way. it was just, I really quite enjoyed it. And I think that it's a good one to always go back to when you want, like, a classic that sort of, you know, sets a lot of the points, right? Damsel in distress that the creature is sort of attracted to in some way for some reason. The scientist versus the capitalist.
Yeah.
Often working on the same team, right? The guy who funds the scientist. And
it's very Gilligan's Island.
Yeah. Sure, yes. Yeah, you could say that. I was thinking more like Jurassic Park.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, the person who was funding wasn't like a total jerk in that. Just
spared no expense.
Yeah.
I also have a water one on my list, but more recent, Deep Rising, which was Stephen Sommers' film before he made the Mummy remake, the first Mummy remake. And it's like there's part of it that's like Poseidon Adventure. It's so funny to watch it unfold because it opens with this like boat with like these hard asses on the open sea, and they're like going somewhere you don't know, but they're like commandos, and they're on this boat that's sort of captained by Treat Williams, and you have no idea where it's going. And then it cuts to this magnificent cruise ship where Anthony Heed is the owner, and Famke Johnson's like a jewel thief who's, you know, on board to steal. And then you cut back to the boat, and you cut back to the cruise ship.
So you think there's a heist movie going on.
And then the mercs get to the boat, and it's like decimated, and people are dead everywhere, save for like a couple of the passengers, including Famke Jensen. And then you find out it's this creature that has taken over the ship, this tentacle monster.
From the deep,
and you don't know if it's like one monster or several monsters. But it's like bizarre. The cast is fascinating because, yeah, you've got Anthony Heed, Famke Johnson, Wes Studi is in it as the head of the Mercs, and the whole thing's being led by Treat Williams.
Yeah, like Treat Williams. Like, where? I haven't heard that name in like 20 years.
Yeah, I know. It's Treat Williams makes some odd decisions. Like, I think he's very undervalued as an actor. But when you go back and watch him, like where he pops up in the 90s, where he's like in this like bizarro like blue film with like Angie Everhart, and then he's like in The Phantom, the Billy Zane superhero movie based on the 30s comic strip, and then he's in Deep Rising, and then a couple of years later he's like the dad in Everwood, and that seems to be the last we hear of Treat Williams, unfortunately. Quickly,
I've got one more.
Okay.
Even though The Thing is like my second favorite horror film of all time and is arguably a creature feature, I'm not going to say The Thing.
Okay.
But because I really like The Thing and I didn't want to say that, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go back to something that really references The Thing a lot, which is The Blob.
Okay.
So both the...
I thought you were going to say The Thing from Another Planet, which was the...
No, but both the original Blob and the remake, the 1988 remake, those were the films I was watching during the giant rainstorm on Saturday.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When you said, did you survive? You didn't get eaten up. I'm like, no, The Blob did not eat me while I was watching that. Similarly, I'd never watched the original Steve McQueen, The Blob. I had seen the 1988 remake, which was a great film on its own for the time, and it also arguably is a really good version of an updated like remake of
that was Dante, right?
Wasn't
Dante? Joe Dante?
It might have been. I seem to remember that it was.
Or am I thinking about Matinee?
No, it was not Joe Dante, but I think that it was someone who I can't think of the name.
It's from the Spielberg school. Yeah.
But both films really great and really of their time. The 1958 version, Steve McQueen, is just like, here are a bunch of teenagers, you know, at the height of like teenagerness, who are trying to save the world and nobody is believing them. It could be Rebel Without a Cause. I mean, it is Rebel Without a Cause, except they're against like a big thing. And then, of course, the end of it is we got to ship it up to the Arctic. Let's hope it doesn't start melting up there. And I'm like, and then the thing comes.
Right. And then global climate change.
Yep.
We're doomed. Cool. my last one is Tremors, which is the 1990 movie with Kevin Bacon, Fred Ward, Reba McEntire, where it's giant worms under the Nevada desert.
Stephen Gross. Or Michael Gross.
Michael Gross.
Stephen Keaton, sorry.
Yeah.
Michael Gross. I never forget him.
Family ties.
Yeah.
It's really this fun thing, and there's a lot of humor in it. It's a great ensemble, but it's also like legit, I think, scary. One of the things I enjoy about Tremors is like the monster logic. Like, they really do a good job of explaining what the monster's capabilities are, what its strengths are, what its weaknesses are, and I enjoyed that a lot, that they're able to explain it in such a way and then use it to get out of various jams and how to get out of impossible situations right up until the very end, which is a great Kevin Bacon moment, I think, still stands. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break here, and then we're going to get into this week's creature feature, which is Crawl. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Striking a match just to watch it burn. I don't want to lose this love. Have it be lost. like I've got something to lose.
Think Pete's gonna respond.
That was a loud gator.
Oh yeah, that was a clip from Crawl. It's a new film from Alexandra Aja, and it stars Kaya Scolidiero and Barry Pepper. So I just, you know, normally I write off a lot of different
that's,
names.
That's it.
But I mean, it is a two person drama. Mm-hmm. Although I mean, there are other human characters who come in and out, like the poor police officer there. But
Yes. It is.
Two people, a daughter and a father, and at least half dozen alligators in the middle of a hurricane, and that's all you need. And I think that's, I think it works.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those films. Like we were just talking about how there's sort of, you know, the solidly like two different types of creature features. One is the sort of B movie, and one is the. You know, the B movie in which you can like yell at the screen and say funny things. And then there's the like, this is just a horror film or a suspense film that happens to have creatures as the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that on the whole, this film is the latter.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, it's a really well-paced, tense sort of thriller with alligators.
Yeah, it's... I was surprised how tense it was. I was surprised how effective the jump scares were. I mean, Alexandra Aja is not inexperienced in the horror realm. He did the Hills Have Eyes remake, and he did the Piranha remake. Although, I mean, the Piranha movie is a very different beast than this because...
That's definitely the former type of
yes, because the movie basically leads up to Jerry McConnell getting his penis bit off.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and then comes back with 3DD.
Right.
The 3D version.
That's right. So yeah. It wasn't subtle. This works as a very confined sort of chamber piece. Mm-hmm. Like, I've
heard it described as an invasion, a home invasion movie.
It is that.
Yeah, it definitely is paced that way.
Yeah, there are so many things going on here because there's the horror of it. There's the creature feature aspect. There is the home invasion aspect. There's also a disaster movie aspect because, like, in much the same way as disaster movies are about solving one problem and then coming face to face with another one and then solving that problem. And, you know, it's about trying to vault these walls that keep appearing in front of you. And there's an aspect to that is to this too, because not only are they being threatened by alligators, they're in this crawl space that is being flooded. So, they're against a clock. And then they have to get out of the area because there's a Category 5 hurricane.
Yeah.
And, you know, they get injured through the course of the film. I feel that the film works very, very well when they are in the crawl space.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like once they kind of get out of the crawl space, once they kind of get out of that danger,
it becomes the film, over the top. Like it's
right.
It falls into the...
Yeah, it doesn't fall apart, but there's a very constrictive feeling to that. Because you know, how are they going to get out of this? The place is flooding. There's alligators in there. That the more water comes in, the more of a threat the alligators are, because the alligators are more effective in water. You know, there's no way out. The alligators are guarding the one way out. Everything they try, again, they're injured. And then as soon as you get sort of above ground into the house, like the options open up, and it becomes a bit more about the thrills and you know, a bit more about the action.
Like, yeah, it's more of a disaster movie at that point.
That's right. Yeah.
as more and more things continue to go wrong that are not related to the alligators, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's basically what I was getting at.
One thing I have learned about this film, which I didn't realize, mm-hmm. is that patio door construction in Florida is not very good, but shower stall door construction is top notch.
is above reproach.
Yes.
There
were, I mean, and obviously I did like this film, but there were a couple of times that I was like, really?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm supposed to believe that alligators can't just, and they're big. Like, these are full-grown alligators. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, New York alligators that are supposed to be, like, super large for some reason.
Yeah.
Toxic stuff. But but they are full-grown alligators, so they're going to be, like, 8-9 feet and strong.
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to believe that they can't just bend these little pipes that are, like, there's a couple of things about... You know, that feel like if you wanted to spend a lot of time dissecting it, you're like, that's not really true. I mean, these people would have been dead very quickly.
Right. I've heard people say that there's a lot of plot armor on the father and the daughter that you're relatively sure that they're probably going to make it to the end. And I get that. I do think that... In a movie like this, you do have to sort of set up means of, I guess, guardrails.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, I was thinking that, too. It's like the alligators would probably, like, the alligators wouldn't recede to the shadows to hide to wait for you to come out and try and get your cell phone, for example.
Yeah.
That's not how an alligator works. What I did appreciate, though, is that they didn't, aside from that, they didn't try to, like, sort of personify the alligators, too.
No.
There's like, ooh, there's the stripe one. We're going to call him Stripey or something. It's, yeah, that it does feel like nature, whether that's the water, whether that's the wind, whether that's the hurricane, whether that's mm-hmm. the gators, nature is kind of the real bad guy here. And speaking of Florida, I've read comments from people who mm-hmm. are Floridian.
Yep.
Who love this movie. I guess there's a very, like, sense of Florida-ness to this, whether that's, like, fear of gators or...
I think it's the refusing to leave in a hurricane, because I actually read something that came out in, like, May, which was, like, all the things wrong with the trailer, because, of course, the trailer only gives you so much.
Yeah.
And I think maybe those people then went to see the film and went, oh, all those things that we thought were wrong, they actually addressed them, because mm-hmm. primarily they're just, like... They are very much like, I'm sorry, we're to believe that people are not having hurricane parties and people are actually, like, leaving? What?
Right.
And then, like, why on earth is there a crawl space? Which, that doesn't necessarily get answered very well.
Mm-hmm.
Though, I mean, it makes sense. Like, it's really not a basement whatsoever.
Right.
The geography of it... seem to slightly expand based on some needs
mm-hmm.
because, you know, if the crawl space is, as we're to believe, when they first go down there, it's literally just 8 inches
mm-hmm.
below the floor
mm-hmm.
and it's where the plumbing is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean,
like
every house,
every
house has to have that. You know, it's not a basement by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But yeah, I did certainly notice that at certain times I'm like, what didn't they, she couldn't stand up straight the first time she was here. But now I feel like she's like the water, the crawl space has expanded to allow for more water or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that there is a lot, right from Floridian's point of view.
Right.
That maybe did not come across in the trailer.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the geography is kind of a bit murky at times mm-hmm. where it's like, well, how deep is this? Where she like is sort of swimming and you know, diving under the water. And it seems to take a while for this crawl space to fill up. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, these are the kind of things that you think about after the fact, too.
Yeah.
I think when you're in the moment in the movie... It's pretty wily, some of the things it does. Like, the characters are smart enough that you can sort of believe they survive, but they occasionally do some dumb things that lets you have those moments. Like, no, don't, like, start dialing 911 on your cell phone while you're still out in the open. Get back behind the pipes, then dial.
Yeah.
Because this is also before they learn there are two alligators in the basement, or in the crawl space, too. Yeah. So, yeah, there's... I do love the... I don't know if they were a family or if they were, like, roommates or something, but, like, the people who were, like, robbing the Quickie Mart across the street.
Yeah, I think there were definitely... It was two brothers, for sure, and then someone else. And I think that's... You know, that was another one of the things, the arguments in this is, like, I'm sorry, there's nobody out there, like, you know, emptying the convenience store of everything. It's like, actually, there is.
Yeah, there is.
They're right there. And they're all prepared. They've got their boat and everything.
Taking everything, including the ATM.
Yeah.
Which, you know, given our experiences in this area of people who, you know, like, shatter doors to get to the ATM machine, I kind of appreciate it. Mm-hmm. There are just the little things like that that I think sort of humanize the movie, because it's, I find, the little touches that sort of make these films, because... Mm-hmm. The disaster aspect too is they tend to get focused on, like, the wind machines and the rain and the dunk tanks and all that, and it's like, these look like hell to shoot. Like, how waterlogged were these actors?
Yeah.
for weeks on end, and, you know, hip deep water, then shoulder deep water, and but it's at its heart still a very human story, and I feel like the human characters don't get lost. There's a very sort of detailed backstory about the father-daughter relationship and the father leaving the mother and why they separated and the connection to the house and things that I think a different movie probably wouldn't have felt compelled to give any sort of real dramatic heft. It would just be the justification that why these two people are in the same place. But I felt that, you know, it was good. They actually made the time to give this a bit more emotional detail. Even if it's just a bit, the focus is still on the gators and the hurricane and all that. But you do become invested in the characters. And there's something very real about the way these two actors were interacting too, that I appreciate. And, like, Barry Pepper is somebody who, I don't think we've seen a lot. Like, he's one of those people.
He's like a character actor. He's really sort of underrated.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I saw the name and I was like, Barry Pepper. Oh, I didn't expect to see that name, but you know, he shows up, he does his job.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's like one of those, like, there's a whole cast of, like, the young men who are, like, part of Private Ryan. You thought they were all kind of going to be big, but, you know, he's kind of the one who's gone, like, not as big, but he was...
I don't know. He's got 54 actor credits here.
Well, I mean, he's not, like, a star. Like, people, like, Hollywood agents aren't like, get me Barry Pepper! but I think that works to his advantage here, because there is a very naturalistic... The way in his portrayal that, you know, you do very believe him as, like, the handyman and his... He's not glamorous, right? And, you know, the way he's reacting in situations and how, like, comforting he is with the actress who plays his daughter and how, like, the way he encourages her. And that's another great thing is, like, we see in the flashback him because she's a swimmer.
She's an apex predator.
She's an apex. Yeah. And that's like, well, who are you? You're an apex predator. And that stuff can be like, when you see it in a script, can seem so cornball. Mm-hmm. But they managed to do it in a way that it's, you could believe that he trained her. You know, this is their mantra. And when she, you know, at the end, and, you know, she's like, what are you? I'm an apex predator. And, like, it's that moment where it's like, we're ready to finally get past these gators and, you know, survive. Yeah. We will survive.
Yeah. The only thing that I think this film didn't achieve is that I don't believe that she learned the lesson that it is okay to fail, which is, I think, the lesson she mostly needs to learn, just like her as a person in general. Mm-hmm. It's okay to not be the best.
Mm-hmm.
You're already better than a lot of people.
Well, it's, I mean... She'll probably have a lot of time to think about that in the hospital from like
and we'll find out during Crawl 2.
From geez. 4 or 5 gator bites. Actually, you mentioned Crawl 2. I saw this headline on Twitter today. Tennessee PD is warning residents to stop flushing drugs down their toilets and sinks out of fear they will create meth gators.
This is how you end up with a gatoroid. You give the gator steroids. That's exactly what happened. Actually, there were chickens that had been fed steroids, fed to the gators. Megapython versus gatoroid. Watch it now.
It's a little thing we like to call the circle of life. Anyway, beware of meth gators. Crawl 2. We'll have to overview that on an upcoming show. That's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or at your favorite iTunes app. Sorry, your favorite podcast app on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Candace, where can people find you?
You can find me on the internet at CINN48SIN48. On Twitter, I seem to be live tweeting my watching of all these things. So, you know.
Cool. Well, people should tune in for that then. I will be here tomorrow, Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Source Guelph, speaking of tuning in. And I will be there with Scotty Hertz. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson or go to my News and Politics site, guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. And we will see you then.